When we read the first epigraph of the book I'm holding, we get a real insight into how all these differing threads come together, the various interests of this author, Maxim Furet, from northeastern Pennsylvania, who has chosen a stirring sentence by Edgar Allan Poe to launch us on our way. We read, "On being entombed in the pit, the blackness of darkness which envelops the victim, the terrific oppression of lungs, the stifling fumes from the damp earth, unite with the ghastly considerations that we are beyond the remotest confines of hope, and that such is the allotted portion of the dead to carry into the human heart a degree of appalling awe and horror not to be tolerated, never to be conceived." Words from the narrative of A. Gordon Pym of Nantucket by Edgar Allan Poe. An apt choice as we prepare to read a story about workers literally entombed in a pit, in a coal mine here. But these words might metaphorically be applied as well to being trapped in a life-threatening addiction, perhaps, or a disabling mental state from which there seems to be no escape. Maxim Furet is a storyteller himself. He has studied creative writing, and he also holds degrees in psychology and organizational communication. He is former director of drug and alcohol services at Danville State Hospital and director of Garden Walk Recovery, an organization promoting wellness through drug prevention and education. And his work in these realms might just be related to a term he uses in the book we're about to encounter. The word is extrication. And in the work he does in psychology and drug and alcohol counseling, there is writing, researching, creating therapeutic strategies so that people can be freed from the ways they are often trapped in life-threatening ways, in the extremist of conditions. And so it is no surprise then that Maxim Furet might be drawn to an event like this one of a mining disaster where people are trapped with their lives at stake, and that he chooses to tell the story through the very experience of the survivors in the extremest of conditions and to ask how such a thing as survival is possible. Yes, technologically, how were the individuals rescued? But more important, what psychological, emotional, and in this case, spiritual resources did they call upon to endure and survive against all odds? His book is titled Shepton, The Myth, Miracle, and Music. As it happens, Maxim Furet is also a music journalist, and he explains he was in fact drawn to telling the story of the Shepton mine disaster because of a song by a rock group, The Boys, from our region, and their tune, Timothy, about miners trapped underground and suggestions of cannibalism. But music is even more important. It's woven into the telling of this tale in a way that reveals something about the lives of the men who were trapped in the mine in Schuylkill County in August of 1963.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire.
Maxim Furet writes, 12 miles to the north on winding route 924 was Hazleton, the city closest to Shepton. Hazleton was the ideal destination for shopping, socializing, and opportunities to taste further aspects of blue-collar culture. Anne's Cafe on East Mine Street was a favorite hangout where Hank Throne listened to the Seaburg jukebox and hillbilly fare like Marty Robbins' Ruby Ann, Buck Owens' Act Naturally, and Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher.
Throne's buddies were coal miner Dave Fellin and Louis Bova, Fallon was from Shepton, further down the road. Fallon was often seen hanging around Dado's bar on the corner of East Pine and Shep Streets, about two blocks from his home. Louis Bova would occasionally stop in. Bova was an ardent dart shooter, expertly towing the line, taking aim, and hitting the bullseye. Bova, Fallon, and Throne are the subjects of our story, writes Furyk. The trio of miners were working-class guys, hardened and calloused beyond their years. They were similar, yet diverse. Fallon's father emigrated from the South Tyrol region between Italy and Austria. Bova was also of Austrian descent, Throne of German heritage. They were popular, described as being mild-mannered, and having lots of friends in the area. They were regular Joes, with aches and pains, practical jokes, and disdain for politicians and intrusive government regulations. That from Chapter 1. Further along, once the mine accident has occurred and the men are trapped, Furyk tells us, Fallon refused to dwell upon the mischief at the café. He was stronger than that, and more than a mere character in one of those heartbreak songs played on the Seaburg jukebox at the café, 500 miles away from home, the end of the world, still, 6 days on the road. Music wasn't about sound, it was about meaning and feeling. In a sense, they were all the same, all revisiting themes of loneliness, longing, and alienation. Perfect songs for a guy trapped below the earth. He knew them all. Fallon had spent a small fortune playing those sad songs and slamming down cold beers one by one. Right now, he had to tune those lonely songs out from his head. He could not allow himself to go crazy. He had to take care of Hank Throne. Words of Maxim Furyk from his book, Shepton, the Myth, Miracle, and Music. Maxim Furyk will be the guest presenter on Sunday, January 8th at 7 p.m. at the Plymouth Historical Society with a program titled The Shepton Mine Disaster, August 1963, as part of a regional observance of Mining History Month in northeastern Pennsylvania. We had a chance to talk with Maxim Furyk. He paid a visit to the WVIA studios to tell us about what actually happened at Shepton.
Davy Fallon was co-owner of the Oneida No. 2 slope. Now, the Shepton mining disaster actually took place in Oneida. So one of the bizarre things about the mythology is that they call it Shepton rather than Oneida. One of the common practices back then was to rob pillars. So they would go down there. They were independent bootleg coal mines, and they would go down there into this mine, start in the back, and they would rob the rich pillars that held up the mine. They were starting in the back. And what happened in August of 63, they went down there, and Fallon and Throne were on one side. Louis Bova was on the other side. They sent down the buggy. They filled it up. Everything was good. They sent it back up. And there's some inconsistencies with the story. Louis Bova either telephoned or he rang a buzzer or he banged for George Walker, the foreman up on the top, to send down the buggy. So the buggy went halfway down before the slope collapsed. A horrible explosion. That buggy was like a dinosaur, this humongous machine, this buggy fell down, and all sorts of timber and rock and debris, you know, millions of tons just fell down. And at that point, I believe that Fallon and Throne jumped into what was called a monkey shaft, a little hole, a little escape passage where they would keep food, tools, or it would be an escape passage in case there was a mining disaster. So they jumped into that. Louis Bova, I believe, was on the other side. So as far as allegations of cannibalism, I believe that they were physically separated from each other, and I don't believe that that happened at all, although, you know, many people still do. Now, what happened then was it didn't look very good for the coal miners. It didn't look like they were going to be able to extricate them. They thought that it would take something like 55 days to go down the shaft to remove the debris and to retimber. They thought about this, they talked about this, they petitioned the Schuylkill courts to see whether or not it would be valid to go and did it make sense to try to go and rescue them. So at that point, it looked bleak. All of the newspapers talked about just how grim it is. There was no hope. Many thought that what they would do is they would just go and bulldoze the top, put some concrete on over it, have the last rites, the Catholic last rites, and then have a memorial. And this had been standard procedure in many coal mining disasters. You know, they never retrieved the bodies. What happened, though, Joe Fallon, who was Davy's estranged brother, now they hadn't spoken for something like 20 years. And how many times have you heard, just like the Jordan brothers, have you heard this story? Joe petitioned the mining officials. They said, "Help, give it a try. Let's go and sink a borehole there just to see if they're still alive." So they were able to drill 2 6-inch boreholes. After 6 days, they were able to locate the miners after 6 days. Now, the reason it took 6 days was because they had the rushes. I mean, for days, the mine just kept them. There were additional cave-ins. They called them rushes. There was also the black dank. It was like a methane type of gas that was just made it dangerous for the rescues to go down there. So they decided that it would cost around $60,000 for a rescue operation. They checked the records of the Oneida slope to see if there was any money there, and there wasn't. So they had to go and petition for the $60,000. So that was the beginning, and we believe that Joe Fallon was one of the people that was instrumental, maybe in an act of contrition and confession and just, you know, resolution, that he reached out and did that. So that was the beginning of the rescue operation, which after 2 weeks they were able to get the men out. In my book, I wanted to write this in psychological terms. We knew the words, Fallon and Throne had been interviewed by the Associated Press. There have been 2 other books, mine is the 3rd book, written about Shepton, several documentaries. So we know their words, but I try to write this book in horrific psychological terms. What would it be like to be crawling down on your hands and knees in total blackness, sucking in coal particles and dirt, having nothing to eat, you know, having that trauma, being traumatized, hearing those cave-ins for days and days and days, being without hope, devoid of hope, which has to be the worst possible condition for a human being. I believe their survival was predicated on what psychologists would call symbiosis, a symbiotic relationship, whereas the older Fallon, 58 years old, mentored the younger Throne, 28 years old, and kept him grounded and talked to him. So they helped each other. I mean, staying alive was a goal for both of them. So they were rescued. When I wrote the chapter called Extrication, I wanted that to be the most horrific, claustrophobic part of the book. And what they did was they had... Now, there's nuances with this. Some people said that the borehole, the rescue hole, was 17 and a half inches. Other people said it was 18 inches in diameter. And what they did was they had this hole. Now, initially, they had capsules. They were going to draw the capsules through that borehole. But they got stuck. They were going to get stuck, so they decided not to use it. So what they did was they used parachute harnesses. And they had some women from Hazleton sew those up, stitch those up. And Fallon wanted Throne to be the first one to go up because he was a bit histrionic. He didn't want him to panic. He didn't want him to be the last one. So what they did was they had to grease each other with this grease, this axle grease, and pull them through this hole. Again, 330 feet, very tight, very claustrophobic. Throne panicked. It took him twice as long to get from the bottom to the top. Fallon, they sent him down some whiskey, so he's drinking whiskey and he's singing, "She'll be coming around the mountain when she comes," as he's coming up there, and he's having a good old time. He came up there in an air of celebration and singing and just grandstanding. Throne got up and he collapsed. He just passed out in the fresh air.
The young guy,
yeah, totally different, but what a template for youth and maturity. I mean, really. And I believe that they developed their own religion when they were down there. It was sort of like tap, pray, dig. They would tap to try to get the attention of the rescue team. They would pray for deliverance, and they would try to dig their way out. So they did that. It was their mantra. It was their religion. They tried to keep themselves sane. The temperature down there was in the 50s. It was, you know, it was just the threat of hypothermia. They would go and hold each other and rub each other and just to keep themselves warm. And then after the 6th day, they were discovered there was a 6-inch borehole And they were able to go and locate them, and then they started to send down light and food. And so they still had another 6 days to wait to be rescued. And that was interesting, too, because Howard Hughes, the billionaire down in Houston, Texas, he had a bit that they utilized for the rescue. They didn't have that up in the Hazleton or Pittsburgh area, so they were able to go and have that flown in by a United States Navy jet. And he was a Texas billionaire, but Hughes was able to secure a United States Navy plane, transported one of his special 6-inch drill bits from Houston to the Hazleton Airport. And then the technology, you know, Shepton utilized a revolutionary means of extricating the trapped miners. They used that borehole technique later. You know, certainly Cue Creek and Chile are the ones that we talk about. But it was just an amazing endeavor. One interesting thing, too, that happened, after they had the 6-inch hole, they had to go and expand on the hole. And they used a thing called the Beast. And it was Pignati Enterprises were able to lend them this, but it was actually a Bucyrus Erie 50R. And it was this 11-story drill that they would use, these humongous drills, to actually be able to go down, you know, all the thousands and thousands of tons of rock and coal. So it was the Beast that actually saved the day. At the end of my research, I came away with a profound respect and admiration for Dave Fallon, this hard-headed, controversial miner that spoke his mind, that would said whatever he thought, and also with Pope John the 23rd, who is larger than life. And the interesting thing was the miracle. Vatican scholars have attributed at least 2 miracles to Pope John the 23rd. A nun in Naples, and the nun had a stomach cancer, and she saw Pope John the 23rd in the room, just on the side, and that seemed to be his MO, like he would just be there almost, you know, to give the person a feeling of safety and reassurance. And she was cured, and medical doctors could not provide an explanation for this. The only word they could come up was miracle. There was another woman that the same thing, the same MO, that the Pope was there on the side. And during Shepton, Pope John the 23rd, again, it was the same modus operandi. He was there on the side, always there for those 2 weeks. They saw him. Fallon, a devout Catholic, knew what he looked like. Throne would call this person the stranger. And when they were extricated from the mine, when they went to the Hazleton State Hospital, Hank Throne saw the picture of Pope John the 23rd, and he said, "Hey, Davey, that's the fella we saw down in the mine." He saw the picture.
He didn't know what the Pope looked like.
He didn't know what the Pope looked like. And then what happened? After they were extricated, that's when some of the really bizarre things started to happen. Now, again, Fallon encouraged Throne not to say anything about what they saw, but he talked about seeing the humanoids, and that was all over the Associated Press. As soon as they got out, there was also rumors of cannibalism. So that wonderful celebration had a taint on it immediately. And Fallon said the Chicago Daily News had a lead story about cannibalism in mines. And part of the lore is that the shortest miner would be sacrificed. Well, in this case, Louis Bova was the shortest miner. And Fallon said only evil men would pose such a question about cannibalism. And he disagreed that they did that. When I interviewed Lou Bova's son, and I was hesitant to do this because I know John Bova has gone through a whole lot of personal trauma. He had been interviewed by Kelly Monitz with the Hazleton Standard Speaker numerous times. But I did contact him and interview him, and he said, yes, I was told this for the first time by my Uncle Joe, and that's the belief that he contends to this day. There's also other people that I talked to in Shepton Oneida that says, yep, that was the word, cannibalism. When I did my research, I spoke with several business people from Hazleton that had a relationship with Fallon. Now, both of these gentlemen agreed to give me their story, but they wanted to remain anonymous. And they did ask Fallon about the cannibalism, about the ancestors sitting on the stairs, about the humanoids, about Pope John the 23rd. And the word was, yes, that's what I saw. That's what I believe. And I'm going to take that to my grave. As far as the miracles, what I call the religious mysticism, or more appropriately, Roman Catholic mysticism, I think there's a couple of elements there. One, the miracle that's been attributed to Pope John the 23rd. Two, the religious convergence. I believe that Hank Throne had a religious convergence in the mind. I believe he found God. He found hope and faith. When he was rescued, he stopped drinking. He was a heavy drinker. He was one of the co-founders of a non-denominational church in Hazleton. And he did go back into the mines up in Nanticoke, believe it or not. But Fallon didn't. Fallon's wife, Anna, wouldn't let him go back into the mines. So he drove a bus and did some other things. The other thing that was bizarre was the humanoid creatures. And they talked about seeing these humanoids. They weren't coal miners. They weren't regular people, but they looked almost like space brothers. They had a bronze look, strange garment, almost like maybe Romanesque alien creatures. Some folks have asserted that these were angels coming to tell them that they would be rescued. And again, I contend that there's two schools of thought. Many people may contend that the miners suffered from hallucinations, from drinking the sulfur water, that it was miners' psychosis, miners' trauma. But I don't believe that. I believe that with hallucinations, usually it's sort of like a confabulation, and you have a hallucination that's short-lived, and then you fill in the gap with another dissimilar hallucination. But with the miners, it had a theme. Pope John the 23rd was there for the 2 weeks, and they saw the Golden City, and they saw stairwells with ancestors sitting there, giving them a feeling of comfort. It was almost like a near-death experience, like going through that light, seeing that. All of this is interesting. There's a lot of rumor, conjecture, and everything, and innuendo, and it sort of makes it interesting. But what happened was there was a guy named Ed Conrad that stepped into the picture. Now, Ed Conrad was a journalist with the Standard Speaker in Hazleton, and he was what I would call a gonzo journalist in the guise of Hunter S. Thompson. In other words, he embedded himself into the story. He befriended Fallon, and what Ed Conrad did was Ed Conrad interviewed Fallon. He taped the interviews, documented Fallon's recollections, and he had an impressive array of notarized letters. And it was Conrad, I believe, single-handedly, who investigated the Shepton mythology, and he brought the events to the attention of prominent scholars and researchers. So I think Fallon has to be given credit for initially taking steps. He wanted to document his story, and he insisted on a psychiatric examination upon his rescue. And he said, I don't care if you think I'm crazy, but I'm not. This is what I experienced. This is what I saw. The other thing, too, it's important to understand that Dave Fallon did not approach the media to discuss this ordeal, but he was responding to their voracious request. And they were the paparazzi of the day. They just continued to hound them and harass them. What was it like to be entombed for those 2 weeks? How did you survive? Did you think you would ever get home? You know, all of this stuff, the cannibalism, just on and on and on, over and over and over. And then Anna, his wife Anna, instructed her husband not to cooperate with the media. And then Fallon, in turn, instructed Throne to resist these potential traps. But it was the younger miner failed to heed that warning, and he was talking to the media, and that's how the word got out. But they were also interviewed, Fallon and Throne, individually and together by several psychiatrists from the University of Pennsylvania, also by Dr. Richard Anderson. He was a United States Navy medical doctor and psychiatrist. The University of Pennsylvania published an article in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and their conclusion observed that neither man exhibited evidence of psychosis or marked mental abnormality when examined, end quote. So again, as a writer, as a researcher, I chose to believe what Fallon and Throne said. So I tell the story in their words. I try to validate it through the documentation of Ed Conrad, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and some of these psychiatrists that they met with. And, you know, when we look at the conclusion, Dave Fallon died 27 years after his rescue. He was 85 years old. That was in 1990. Throne lived 35 years after his rescue, and he died at the age of 63. That was in 1998. But it was interesting because Fallon had been pretty forthcoming and candid about his disclosures. Again, he said he didn't care what people thought. He wasn't insane. He knew what he saw. He said, I'm just a hard-headed miner, and I know what I saw. But there was something that he was holding back, and he was being interviewed by the Philadelphia paper, And there was something that he declined to examine. He says, there's something I'm not going to tell you about. Those were his cryptic words. He said that I will talk about all this other stuff, but there's some things I can never tell you about. So we don't know what that was, but he took that. And I was writing that. I know the first draft, I said that he took that, unfortunately, to his grave. And then I changed it, and I think I wrote he took that purposefully to his grave. He knew what he was holding back. He knew what he wasn't going to share. So again, Shepton is something that the scientific community has difficulty in defining. It lies outside of our scientific realm of understanding and that empirical knowledge. I don't think the scientific community has language to articulate themes of the supernatural. And immediately when something like this happens, it's the same knee-jerk response, hallucinations, minor psychosis, you know, they're insane. But what if this is part of a larger paradigm, something large beyond what we know, something, things that we can't even explain and articulate? And I believe that that's what Shepton is, the Shepton mythology, again, the coal region's last remaining mystery, the coal region's urban legend. And this is something that we need to get excited about, especially for the younger generation. They need to know that it was the Pennsylvania coal region, that anthracite region from Scranton down to Dauphin County, 100 miles by 30 miles, that fueled the Industrial Revolution. We did it right here in northeastern Pennsylvania. We fueled the Industrial Revolution, and I think there needs to be, you know, more said about this. They do a yearly and annual minor celebration in January, and I'm going to be at the Plymouth Historical Society. I'm going to be the first one on the docket, so I'm going to be talking about the Shepton mythology. I'll be doing a PowerPoint presentation about Shepton and some of the weird things that happened there. But I'm so glad to be a part of this. You know, people like Dave Braca and like Bob Walensky, who's written so many books, the historian and the academic. And I'm just hoping that those folks will be able to accept some of my themes of the miraculous and supernatural.
Author, researcher, and music journalist from northeastern Pennsylvania, Maxim Furyk, speaking with us about his book titled Shepton, the Myth, Miracle, and Music. Maxim Furyk will be the guest presenter on Sunday, January 8th at 7 p.m. at the Plymouth Historical Society with a program titled The Shepton Mine Disaster, August 1963, as part of a regional observance of Mining History Month in northeastern Pennsylvania. The event is free and open to the public. For more information on the web, you may check Maxim Furyk's website, sheptonmyth.com, S-H-E-P-P-T-O-N, myth.com, and Furyk is spelled F-U-R-E-K. Maxim Furyk, and his website is sheptonmyth.com. He is a music journalist, the author of a very popular book about the Jordan Brothers from Frackville, the first to record Gimme Some Lovin', even though England's Spencer Davis Group had written the tune, and The Jordan Brothers, a musical biography of rock's Fortunate Sons from 1986. Maxim Furyk, part of Mining History Month in northeastern Pennsylvania. And you can hear a public presentation hosted by the Plymouth Historical Society at 7 in the evening on Sunday, January 8th. The program titled The Shepton Mine Disaster, August 1963. The address for the Plymouth Borough Municipal Building, 162 West Shawnee Avenue, and that is in Plymouth. For more information on the web, sheptonmyth.com, sheptonmyth.com.